Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome. My name is Minouche Shafiq, and I'm the director of the London School of Economics, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you here on behalf of the LSE, but also on behalf of University College Dublin, who are hosting with us, and on behalf of the LSE's European Institute and Institute for Global Affairs, which are co-hosting this event. I'm especially pleased and honored to welcome Peter Sutherland's family, who are here with us in the first row, his wife, Maruja, his children, Shane, Ian, and Natalia, and his sister, Karen, who's also here. It's such an honor for us to have you here. It's also a great pleasure for me to welcome Pascal Lamy at the LSE today in this event in honor of Peter Sutherland. Let me start with Peter, and then I'll say something about Pascal. Peter Sutherland was a hugely influential international figure. He held so many important jobs. I won't list them all because you will... you will see. He was European Commissioner for Competition. He was the founding Director General of the World Trade Organization. He was Chair of Goldman Sachs. He was the UN Special Representative on International Migration. But for us, the most important job he ever held was to be the Chair of the Council and the Court of the London School of Economics. He played that role from 2008 to 2015, and he oversaw an incredibly important period in the school's history and was a much, much loved figure here. This was his, I hope you'll don't mind us saying, his second home. And when we tried to think about who could honor him in the great intellectual tradition that he was a part of, we could think of no one better than Pascal Lamy. Pascal, too, has held a series of important international jobs, and some of them in Peter's footsteps. He, too, was a European commissioner. He was chief of staff for the president of the commission, Jacques Delors, and he also was a director general of the World Trade Organization. And both of them shared a huge personal commitment to an internationalist perspective and to seeing politics as a source of progressive change in the world. In today's lecture, Pascal will discuss why Peter was and still is right in promoting a rules-based international trading system, in which he was a huge architect as the inaugural director of the World Trade Organization. And he and I will explore in our conversation the current challenges facing global trade and some discussion around what should be done about it going forward. And in particular, trying to think about what would Peter say to us today. For those Twitter users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Sutherland, and I'd ask you to put your phones on silent so that we don't disrupt the event. But please join me in welcoming Pascal Lamy to deliver the Peter Sutherland Memorial Lecture. Okay, so Pascal, let's start with the present. Let's start with the current situation of global trade, which is arguably at a level of challenge to the global international trading system that we have not seen in our lifetimes. Rising protectionism, an emerging trade war between the U.S. and China. What is your take on the current situation?
Well, I mean, I would agree with you that the level of trade tensions is totally unprecedented since roughly 1947, when the GATT was born, which is, by the way, the year I was born, 1 year after Peter Sutherland. So, in a way, if you look at this period, we now are in an exceptional period, and that stems from one place, which is Washington, which in many ways is all the more surprising that the U.S. had been, if not the only architect of the present world order before Trump started disordering it, there was one of the major patrons, architects, and benefiters from the system. So that's a situation which I think we have. Not that, and we probably will come back to that in the discussion, not that other things have not changed for the last 10 or 15 years in attitude to globalization or to trade openness. There is a bit of that everywhere, depending on what country you look at. But the big difference, the big change, the big surprise is that a U.S. president was elected on a protectionist platform. This is a political reality which is possibly a point of inflection or a point of rupture. Now, whether this will evolve in an inflection, a change from what previously was there, or whether this will lead to a rupture, is unclear. What Donald Trump is after is unclear.
Depending perhaps even on, to him.
Well, depending on who you talk to in Washington, depending on which of the tweets you consider, and as you know, there are many in different directions. One interpretation is that he's after a change of paradigm. Mm. What he wants to get rid of is globalization, because he deeply believes that globalization, which served the U.S. interests worldwide for decades, are now working well for China, too well for China, hence not well for U.S. And I think what he does, and we also probably will come back to that, cannot be interpreted nor observed without a strong geopolitical rivalry between U.S. and China? Mm-hmm. Or is Trump after improving the system? Is he about destroying it or is he about improving it? We don't know. It may be that, he's just implementing what he wrote in The Art of the Deal, which is that in order to get a proper advantage in a negotiation, you just have to punch your counterpart a lot. Yeah. And then when you stop, he or she is so happy that he's making concessions, which otherwise he or she would not have given. Mm. It may be that's the case. Mm. And by the way, and I think Peter Sutherland would agree with that, by the way, Trump has succeeded in pointing one issue, which is that the existing rule book of the WTO needs to be adjusted. We're all in favor, maybe even Trump is in favor of a rules-based trading system, except that he wants to change the rules. And in some cases, he is right that the rules need to be changed.
Well, let's go back to the beginning. And you knew Peter when you were chief of staff for Delors, and he was a European commissioner, and you saw the evolution of his views on trade and how important they were in shaping the current international system that is in the currently under so much stress. Tell us a little bit about how his views on trade evolved, and what his views would be of the current juncture.
Well, I mean, you're right. First time I met with Peter was when Delors was nominated as president of the Commission after the Fontainebleau European Council in July 84. Then Delors asked me whether I would follow him as a chief of staff after quite a number of hesitations. I said yes, and then he started gathering thoughts and people and portfolios in order to be ready for the next January 85, where he would take over. And Delors at the time did a sort of grand tour of European capitals with a sort of a questionnaire. He had a to-do list with 10 items. Would it be defense, money, blah, blah, blah. And then at the end of his tour, he said, oh, number one is internal market. And that's how the 1992 thing came over. And he also, in the meantime, cooked his quote-unquote government in allocating portfolios to the right people, including to Peter Sutherland, who had he had considered as young, brilliant, stubborn, lawyer. And that's how Peter got competition, which for somebody who was very junior by European Commission standards was a big surprise.
Portfolio, yeah.
Now, why did he put Sutherland with competition? Because Sutherland was, and had struck the law about that, was a sort of deep believer in market opening, market forces. He wanted to have Cofield on the internal market because of the Thatcher connection. And to be frank, for a president of the Commission at the time, the Thatcher connection was more important than the Irish connection. So this is how Cofield got internal market and Sutherland got competition. Now, I've tried to understand since why had Peter this sort of deep, let me call it faith. It's not a belief. It's not a thought. It's a faith. Mm. Why did he have such a big faith in trade opening? I think stems from his origins. I'm speaking under your control, but how I see it, it really is deeply rooted in his political sort of Fine Gael belonging, and B, in his, let's say, Catholic faith. His deeply Irish commitment was about Ireland becoming independent. That was the stream. Except that De Valera wanted Ireland to become independent as a sort of a rural state. Sutherland was a young Turk who basically said, we have to modernize this economy. We have to stop being the poorest of the rich, which Ireland was at the time, and he undoubtedly was among your young Turks in Fine Gael who departed from the sort of ultra-ruralistic doctrine of independence in order to move to economic modernization. And he was one of those who, I think, was very instrumental in turning this sort of poor, backward country into a Celtic tiger. So that's, I think, one of the motivations. So it has to do with his view of what were the right politics for his country. And then, of course, I think there is something about his sort of concept, which is deeply enshrined in his Catholic faith. I mean, the sort of care about poor people, underprivileged. And he thought deeply, and I remember discussions with him about this, that, for instance, that was the way forward for developing countries. He was one of the first, which I heard, saying, pouring them with money is not the right thing to do. We'd better open our markets. And there is, by the way, a trace of Sutherland, of the initiative I took when I was European Trade Commissioner with everything but arms, which was freeing up duty-free, quota-free, the European market to the least developed countries on the planet. This is typical Sutherland legacy.
And in many ways, he was right about that, because globalization has delivered the fastest reduction in poverty the world has ever seen. But paradoxically, the backlash today is coming not from poor countries, but from rich countries. So what do you think his analysis of the current predicament would be? I'm sure he would be appalled,
No doubt.
What would be his or your diagnosis of where the current backlash against globalization is coming from and what should be done about it?
Well, I mean, I think what has happened is that as compared to his times, let's say sort of 90s, in terms of forging a doctrine, a vision, I think what has happened is that globalization has become deeper, stronger, larger. And the sort of Ricardo Schumpeterian equation, which is inherent to globalization, which is, you know, it works because it's painful because it works, which is the right sort of, I mean, if I have to explain how trade works in the LSE, in a big audience, I'll say, look, guys, it's painful because it works, and it works because it's painful, because it reallocates factors of production in a way that create efficiency. The problem being that the way these efficiencies occur and what you do with these efficiencies in terms of welfare has gone wrong in a way. So the benefits which we all attributed and which I think we still must attribute to opening trade only accrue in a way that is sustainable politically if the negative impact of globalization are addressed. And it's okay, and I'm Cartesian enough to say, look, the overall balance is extremely positive. Of course, that's true. But, you know, winners of globalization are silent and losers are vocal. And this, I think, is what makes a difference. Not the only difference. As we just said, there is in the present situation an international dimension. But there is basically a domestic dimension, which is that a number of people believe they've not been properly served by this system. It has worked better for others than for them, which is the sort of root of the sort of populistic surge which we are witnessing, at least in the Western world, although we have clear signs of populism in the non-Western world.
Yeah.
And then there is this international dimension, which in a way is based on the same, not for me, concept. After all, what Trump says about America first and why should we let these Chinese cheat us, it's roughly the same thing. But so there is, I think, the root of the problem is A, our domestic welfare systems have not been adjusted to the strengths of globalization, which, of course, technological progress accelerates. And we know that opening trade is an accelerator of technological change. We've known that forever. Why has IP thief been so popular on history? It's because people want to bring this technology with them. And then there is this international dimension. I think the first one has to be addressed domestically. It is an issue of domestic policies because redistribution can only work in a place where people accept redistribution, which means they accept a sense of belonging that, I mean, the group needs to be governed.
Yes.
This does not exist at global level. And at global level, we have this US-China rivalry, and the big question, and where I'm opposed to what Trump does, I'm not saying China is my dream. One of the reasons why I'm still, like Peter, sort of deep believer in European integration is that I don't want my grandchildren to be either Trump America or Xi Jinping Chinese. If that's the only option, we'll have a big problem. I mean, I will have a big problem wherever I will be. But so that's the Chinese are different. They have a political system that is different. They have a way of thinking things that is different. I'm a Democrat. I'm a strong believer in civil liberties. The Chinese are on another planet from this point of view. But if we have to live in the next 50 years with a US-China geopolitical rivalry, which is, I think, what we have to be prepared to live. I prefer this rivalry to take place with a China that opens rather than a China that closes.
Yeah.
And what Trump is doing is reinforcing in China the part of the system that is reluctant to opening. And I think this is a big geopolitical mistake.
Interesting. I'm going to quote you back to yourself. At an event you and I were at a couple of years ago, you said, the U.S. is all about the individual. China or Asia, loosely speaking, is all about the collective. And what's unique about Europe is that we try and balance individual rights with looking out for the collective. Why do you think that that ability to look after the collective, the wealth which is embodied in the welfare state, failed to, I don't want to tame the worst aspects of globalization? Why did the political system fail us?
First, it has not failed everywhere. It has failed in the US more than Europe,
yes,
for ideological reason. And by the way, it probably has failed in UK more than the continent, which is why we have Brexit.
Yes.
I think the fundamental reason behind this is that the concept we have of the welfare state, i.e. basically a necessity of redistribution to reduce social insecurity, this concept has remained while the manifestations, the realities, the causes of social insecurity have changed. Mm-hmm. So we have a system that was there
for
to address
the old economy. Yeah.
The previous sort of war against insecurity. In an economy which is dominated by industry, with more industry than services, with people, with teams, with strong trade unions, and so on, to something which is much more individualized, with pressure much more on people, with a level of change in qualifications and work positions that is totally unprecedented in terms of change, and we haven't adjusted to that. And it is difficult to adjust to that while our civilization is moving people more individualistic. Mm-hmm. And there are good reasons that people are becoming more individualistic, not least because people are, in a way, more educated than they were, and they follow less than in the past. People, parties, churches, whatever movement, tell them what to do, what to vote, what to think. And I think this is a plus. And I think Peter Sutherland would have agreed that, raising the level of human capacity is a great thing to do. But true, it leads to more individualistic positions, hence a more difficult coexistence with welfare systems. And I think we still believe in Europe. If you want to understand the difference between US and Europe on this thing, you have to look at a poll which asks Europeans, are social inequalities a problem? Mm-hmm. The answer in Europe is 75% yes. Yeah. US, 60% yes. 15% difference, not much. Now, if the next question is, who should care? Should the state get involved in addressing this problem? The EU answer is yes, 65%. Mm. The US answer is yes, 30%. Mm. And this is a huge difference in civilization. And this is something which we have to know. I believe what I hear and what I've observed when I went out of the EU, like Peter in Geneva, I think the rest of the world still perceives Europe as the most balanced version of globalization or civilization. Mm-hmm. Whether we will be able to keep this sort of comparative advantage in sort of humanism, human dignity, not sure.
Well, let's turn then to possible solutions. What are the solutions? Where do you see this going? Is WTO reform central? Is a shift toward more bilateral and regional trade arrangements inevitable? How do you see a solution to the current crisis in international trade?
So, starting from where we were, I see solutions, A, in addressing domestic problems, nothing to do with trade. Education, industrial policy, innovation, labor market, nothing to do with trade. It's equipping people to better cope with the gains in efficiencies that trade opening produces to the cost of painful transformations. And transformations which, again, are probably more painful than they were at the time when Peter Sutherland forged his view that trade opening was the way to go. Second, if possible, contain this US-China rivalry. And then if we do that, there is a space for, you're right, WTO reform. And the reality is that for a number of reasons, among which a low-level but still existing tension between US and China for the last 15 years in WTO has, in a way, prevented what should have been done, which is to update the rule book. And the basic reason behind that is that China joined WTO in 2001 under terms which were very costly for them as compared to the WTO regime of other developing countries, and that because of that, since then, they haven't accepted any substantial changes. Nor, by the way, have EU, US, and Japan properly identified, and I was one of them when I was a European Trade Commissioner, properly identified that getting a bigger quantum of market access to China than in other developing countries was the right thing to do. But we didn't apply this to the rules part of the WTO system. It was about getting a larger chunk of the Chinese market. And in a way, we were so appetized by this and by the sort of the people who were pushing us to open in services, in industry, in car, in distribution, that we probably did not do enough on the leveling the playing field with China. And the main reason for that was that at the time, China had a regime of non-market economy status in WTO, and that if you were in WTO a non-market economy status, others could treat your exports through anti-dumping or safeguards or countervailing duties in a way that made this kind of obstacle easier than for a normal economy. So in a way, we thought we would be protected and we could harm the Chinese if necessary with exceptional measures, which little by little China said, oh, come on, we're not anymore there. And this is where the big paradox lies, and this is where is the crux of WTO reform. Leaving aside things which have to be done like the appellate body, jurisprudence and process. I mean, the US are obsessed about that because they've lost so many cases. And it happened that their trade negotiator, like often in the US, was a trade lawyer. And the guy who was working for the steel industry lost quite a number of cases in the court. Because of an obscure anti-dumping issue, which is called zeroing, and I'm not going to enter into that. So, but are the US totally wrong in saying that the appellate body sometimes overinterpreted the book? No. I am of the view, I could never say that when I was DG of WTO, that in some areas, for instance, safeguards, the appellate body jurisprudence has excessively shrunk the capacity of WTO members to recourse to safeguards, which I think is a useful safety valve. If you want to open trade, you need to have safety valves. Anti-dumping or safeguards are one. So let's leave that aside. The big question is China. And we have to recognize that, notably in the area of subsidies, where China, with its huge state-driven part of its economy, China is using subsidization in a way that is probably not fit with the rules of global capitalism. Now, whether we like it or not, we live within a system which is called global market capitalism, and Peter was a sort of very strong sort of supporter of that, not neglecting the sort of pain part, as we said, but he was a very strong supporter of that. And the reality is that today, somewhere between 30 and 40% of the Chinese economy is under serious state control. And the coexistence of such a system with a global rules-based system is a problem. And I think the Chinese recognize that. So the question then is, if you agree that fixing the appellate body issue and addressing this issue are the two priorities, this is my answer to your question, Milosz. That's where we should start. This is where WTO reform has to be. I would totally counter-advise putting this in the hands of 100 diplomats in Geneva. If you ask them for a scoping exercise of what needs to be done in order to fix WTO, we will be there 5 years from now. No doubt about that. So it's a sort of top-down thing. And the top-down thing has to come, I think, within a triangle, which is EU-Japan, which is what they are trying to do, by the way, talking to both the Chinese and the US separately in order to sort of pre-cook something, if possible, and then putting China and US around the table with something that has been properly prepared. Now, again, this will only work under the assumption that the US are after improving the system. If they are after killing the system, then you need a plan B. If Trump is serious about leaving WTO, and he may be serious, maybe it's not just the art of the deal, maybe this is what he wants to do, and he's just giving a pre-notice that he will do that, and then he will say, no, I told you, if you don't fix it, so if that's the case, you need to think
something
about WTO minus US.
Although the recent agreement with Canada and Mexico, even though he threatened to leave NAFTA, in the end, they made some modest reforms to NAFTA, and then they stayed in the system. So is that recent agreement with Canada and Mexico a potential sign that they want a different system, not to destroy the system?
It's a very good question. But again, you have signals in both directions.
Yes.
Now, if I analyze the new NAFTA, which has a code name which nobody
can remember.
USMCA, which in a way is very strange to sort of initials that don't really work. If I look at what's in there, you're absolutely right. There is a bit of deglobalization. A bit.
Yeah.
Notably in the car industry, which, as you know,
very
is the obsession.
Cars. Okay. Yeah.
But not much. Mm. By the way, if you look at how the Koreans renegotiated the bilateral agreement for the third time in 10 years with the US, it's exactly the same. Except that there are a few things, like, for instance, the Koreans accepting to import cars that are not fit with Korean car regulations, which is a bit of a worry, because this is a sort of a breach of normal practice. So maybe you're right, and maybe this will happen. And at the end of the day, a fix will be negotiated. Never do. But be careful, because in the same week as they announce the thing on the weekend, you have a speech by Mike Spence at the Hudson Institute, which we should read, which is a total declaration of Cold War to China. The list of misgriefs and accusations the U.S. vice president has pronounced against China on 10 or 15 counts is really striking. So you have it both ways, and which of these two directions are the ones? And I think what we have to do is try and, again, interpret it the way we believe is the most fit for us, which is WTO reform. And if we get it wrong, we have to be ready to go back to the ITO, which was the International Trade Organization, which the US did not ratify in 1947, which is why we turned it into GATT, which then we turned it into WTO. We have intellectually to be strong enough to have a plan B, knowing that having a plan B is sometimes the best way to make sure that plan A works.
Right. Okay, last question for me. I now often go to dinners where people say, let's not talk about Brexit until dessert. Not because it's a sweet subject, but because if you start with Brexit in the UK, you talk about nothing else, so I saved it for last. but I have no doubt that Peter Sutherland opposed Brexit. It must have been especially painful as an Irish person to see the Irish border under threat, given the history. And it is, as I think as you have said, Brexit is a sort of another example of deglobalization. Mm-hmm. What do you think will happen with Brexit, and how do you see it as part of this wider challenge to the global trading system?
Well, I think you're right, Minouche, to in fact connect this with the previous part of the discussion. Because, after all, Brexit is an attempt to mini deglobalize. I'm well placed to know how much the Brits pushed for removing frontiers with the 1992 internal market, and that was the sort of big substantial alliance between Delors and Thatcher at the time, and they remained aligned for a long time until Delors appeared at the Trade Union Congress and they started singing Frère Jacques, which Thatcher thought was a total provocation, and from this song on, things started getting wrong. But before that, it was okay. Now, and I've often said that, from the very beginning, including here in London or elsewhere in UK, that getting the UK egg out of the EU omelette would be a very tough thing to do, which it is. Because, if building the internal market was a good thing, de-building it is a bad thing. And the world hasn't changed in a way that what was a good thing 20 years ago has become a bad thing. That doesn't work. So that's where we are. And my own expectation, I believe if Trump is about deglobalization, he will only have a very limited success. I think we've reached a stage of globalization, a stage of interpenetration of production systems of goods and services, which Peter Sutherland would have liked, because it's a very efficient one, at least a more efficient one than the previous one. We've reached such a state that the cost of deglobalization has become much more important now than it was 30 years ago, which is, by the way, what we are observing with Brexit. And the whole problem with Brexit, I think, is how can you exit EU politically without exiting EU economically? And that's what Brino is about. I know that Bruno is a provocation for part of the Brexiters, but in a way that's the only solution. The only solution is to find a way that you exit politically, you're not part of the EU anymore, but at a cost which is limited. And the way to limit the cost is not to really exit economically, whatever shape this takes. So I think at the end of the day, this will be the result. It's the only solution to this incredibly complex combination of passion and rationality. Again, it's not something of a negotiation between EU and UK. I've said this repeatedly. The only negotiation that matters is a UK-UK negotiation. That's where the problem of how thick should be the border, which is the real issue, should be fixed. We are not going to fix this problem. It's for UK to decide whether they want a thick border, which is a real solid exit at a real solid cost, because a thick border is costly, or whether you want a less costly border, which is a thin border, in which case the point will be made that you keep following EU rules, which is what a thin border is about, in which case after some time people will say, now why did we quit if it's too... So it's the Swiss syndrome. I was discussing this morning here at the LSE, and I was saying, you know, if you want somebody to talk to Brexit in a serious seminar, ask Alexandre Fazel, who's the Swiss ambassador in London, to tell people in London how it works. He would explain to you how it works. He would explain to you that the way to make it work is to think at night that you've left, and then during the day realize that you've not left. But the good thing is that there is a night every day.
And you'll sleep better at night, but in the morning you'll be productive.
That's the Swiss experience.
Well, I think that's a very good point to open up the discussion to the audience. Let me ask, invite people to ask any questions or make any comments, and if you could introduce yourself once you've done that. I'll start with the lady here and then come to Kevin. Why don't you stand up, if that's okay? And I believe there's a mic coming, and if you could just introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Marina Cino from the European Institute, and I would like to add a little insight on Peter Sutherland, because he was not only commissioner for competition, but he was a commissioner for education in 1985. And what he did in that year for education policy, which is still a very domestic competence, was much more than any other commissioners did. He launched the Erasmus program, the Comet program, and I'm saying this because for him, the idea of education was completely linked to the idea of competition. Yeah. So for him, the fact of having students able to circulate around Europe, learning new techniques in countries, coming back, creating links and ties with the companies, was very important. So we were saying, what could be the solution? You were mentioning enhancing the human capacities, and for him, education was one of the way to do this. I just want to add this because I think it's nice to remember also this other side. Thank you.
Thank you for pointing that out. I've also been told that there are now, as a result of the Erasmus program, about 1 million Erasmus babies in Europe who are the product of cross-European relationships. And that is also a wonderful legacy for Europe. Kevin. I think the mic here, yeah.
Thank you very much, Kevin Featherstone from the European Institute. A couple of years ago, Jean Pisani-Ferry and the Bruegel think tank suggested at the beginning of the Brexit process that the solution was what they called a continental partnership. And that continental partnership seemed to be very close to your point about economic integration without the politics. I wonder, if you were advising the Macron presidency, whether the logic of what you've just been saying is to go back to the Continental Partnership, which seemed to be rejected perhaps prematurely.
Okay. A word on Peter Sutherland and education, which, as you rightly said, he, at the beginning, in the first year of his tenure in the EU Commission, he was given education by Delors, together with competition. Competition was a big thing. Education at the time was a very thin EU competence, if ever it was a competence. But still, they together got this Erasmus thing on life. And it was a terrible fight. And what Peter loved in this fight is that the ones he had to fight with was UK, who at the time was vehemently opposed to bringing anything like education in the Euro something. And it was the case for a long time, and at the time you needed unanimity in order to do something at EU level. We needed unanimity, if it wasn't within the EU competence, to bring it into a EU action. And then we had the Luxembourg Treaty about the internal market, and then the thing was blocked in the Council, and it was a big fight, and then Sutherland was the one that told Delors, now that we have a majority for the internal market, why don't you say that Erasmus is about free circulation? It's not about education. Nothing to do with education. It's about youngsters being able to go elsewhere. And that's how it worked. And at the time, I remember full well, that some in the British system thought they should attack this at the European Court of Justice as a sort of overreaching in EU competence. So that's an area where his education and his law sort of capacities worked well. On the Pisani-Ferry Bruegel, I mean, you're right, it didn't float. It didn't float more than a fortnight. Now, the reason why it didn't float is quite simple, is that the internal market cannot have a variable geometry. You can have a variable geometry in many areas, but not in the internal market, where the internal market is a sort of rules-based system that you recognize, mutual recognition, harmonization. And Article 1 of rule is that the rule is the same for everybody, and especially in this area of economic integration. Now, you can think of a variable geometry in defense, in research, in currency. We have a variable geometry in currency. You can think of variable geometry in border controls. We have a variable geometry with Schengen, but not in the internal market. And this is the crux of UK exiting, because the crux of UK exiting is whether the UK will or not follow EU regulations. Whichever way, following EU regulations is done, whether it's within the customs union, the internal market, whether it's a pure unilaterally decided UK stance that UK wants to follow EU rules. In which case there will be a border, but the border will be thin. Although there will be a border, because if you exit, you cannot trust people as much if they're out as if they were in. And so a border, what is a border in today's world? A border is a place where you check regulatory conformity. I mean, tariffs or other things like this are things of the past. A border is a sort of virtual thing, but where you check regulatory conformity. And by the way, there is a border in services, although There's no tariff on services, and although you can't control a service when it passes crosses the border, but there is a regulatory discrepancy which is called a border and which we should call a border.
Okay. Others? Gentleman in the back. And a second one in the back. Maybe we'll take those two together, Pascal. And then.
Thank you very much. My name is Rafael Leal. I'm a member of the public. I want to get back to you on the comparison you made between the United States and Europe. And it seems to me that the U.S. is much more dynamic. There's much more technology, much more innovation, great universities. I'm not saying that there aren't. For example, the LSE is one. unemployment is much lower than here. And so if I were young, or actually younger than I am, it seems to me I would love to be on the other side of the Atlantic, because my take is that the other side of the Atlantic seems to be brighter, and I wanted to hear your views on this. Thank you.
And we'll take the second question from the back.
Alexandra Soika, University Carlos III de Madrid, and I'm visiting here at the European Institute. Thanks so much for your very interesting remarks. And I wanted to go back to your point about the backlash and the roots of the backlash to globalization. You mentioned that we should look for solutions at the national levels. But I was wondering, what do you think about a redistribution at the European level? Do you think, and I mean at the EU level, of course, be it with Britain or without, probably more possible without. But I was wondering whether you see a feasible system that could bring together also closer the EU member states and at the same time work to deal with this issue. Thank you.
Pascal.
Okay, on the first question, I mean, I totally agree that overall, for the last 20 or 30 years, the US has been a more dynamic economy, a more innovative economy. They have a larger rate of employment. That's true. That's the face of it. But if that is true, why did people vote Trump? There's something else that doesn't work in the US that brings this sort of extreme polarization, which we are now witnessing, whether it's a geographic polarization. We all remember the maps of who voted Trump and who voted Clinton. It's amazingly different. So you're absolutely right. The US is a more dynamic system, but with a social system that's more painful than ours. And you know, you sometimes have to find the proper compromise between efficiency and, let's say, justice. And this is a question of philosophy. It's a question of political attitude. It happens that Europe is less tolerant to inequality than the US. I happen to share this view, for a variety of reasons, and I think, going back to Peter Sutherland, that was also the way he saw things. But I still believe that, provided we change a number of things in the way we run our countries in Europe, we can reconcile a more dynamic economy with a social system that is fairer than the US one. And I'm not sure that if the US keep ultra-polarizing the way they do, I'm not sure that in 20 or 30 years this country will not have larger problems of conflicting identities within the country that will sort of break so much social cohesion. And again, they have a way of thinking that necessitates less social cohesion than we do. But I'm not sure that the way things are going, they will always keep this comparative advantage. And by the way, one of the reasons why they have this comparative advantage is that they've been better than us at, for instance, innovation. And there are structural reasons why we are less good than the US, and by the way, than China now, at switching from research and innovation. This is not a fatality. This is something, in my view, we can address. going back to Europe, would we have reached the level of internal market which the US have, our economy would be more dynamic. I mean, we decided to do that 30 years ago. We've done it 80% for goods. We've done it 40% for services. Assuming services are a bit less traded than goods because of proximity, you know, adherences, the average is probably in an economy which is 70% services, and taking into account that services are less tradable than goods, but we probably have done our internal market 60%. So there's a huge 40% bit of efficiencies that would probably dynamize the European economy. Now, they also have a demographic system that is more dynamic than ours. Now, why do they have a demographic system that is more dynamic? Because they've accepted a lot of migration, which now Trump is trying to limit. So this is not, I think, black and white. On the second question, I mean, social systems are about solidarity. You accept redistribution of income or wealth in the sake of belonging to a group where you believe solidarity needs to take place. Now, some more than others, and this is again a problem of political philosophy, but what matters first and foremost is the sense of belonging. Now, do not dream of a European system that would be good at redistribution in emotional terms the way national systems are. The level of belonging is not the same. Now, not that nothing can be done, but it's marginal as compared to what you can do at national level. And I'm talking there about redistribution system. I'm not talking about a legislation on workers' rights or on whether, you know, you can spend 6 hours or 9 hours on facing a screen. And that's something which is a regulatory issue, which has competitiveness consequences. And then there's a case for aligning a number of standards at EU level. But how much is a minimum wage? We haven't even crossed the stage at EU level that say there has to be a minimum wage everywhere. And I'm not saying I think we should have that, but I'm not saying the same. It should be the same everywhere. Now, how much of social security does it work with contributions? Does it work with taxes? All these things are a matter of collective preferences which are deeply enshrined in national cultures. Now, true, I was an advocate of having a European fund to address problems of globalization when trade opening creates ruptures in some industries. Because I believe that for political reasons, saying trade policy is run at the EU, but you leave the consequences of that with the member states in a union where social systems are extremely heterogeneous, is prone to political criticism. But let's be frank, this has not worked. We have a European fund, how is it called, adjustment to globalization, as if, by the way, globalization was something you only have to adjust, but leave that semantic issue aside. Eurospeak has never been good at making things understandable. That's an intrinsic problem. But, for instance, this fund doesn't work well. No. And the reason why it doesn't work well is that in order to address the consequences of industrial transformation, rupture, I mean, you need to be near to the ground. Mm-hmm. And by the way, if you look at the US, it's exactly the same. The US have had a system, a trade adjustment fund.
That's right.
And it never really worked. The only place where it has worked somehow is Australia. Mm.
But there have been proposals to build a European fund which pooled risks around unemployment insurance, for example, which has an element of fiscal
That's treatment. Different.
That,
and I think, I mean, first, it's work. Within the Eurozone, not for the whole, and B, it is one of the structural measures that the French and the Germans have agreed should be considered as a follow-up to the Meseberg agreement. And there still is a nuance between the French that would like it to be a budget and the German that would like it to be a reinsurance system. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it is a structural issue that is there to address problems of limiting divergence in macroeconomics rather than just making social security systems work.
Yeah. Gentleman here, and then maybe the one in the back there. Oh, we've got lots coming.
Thank you. Andrew Carr, a comment and a question. I was a member of Lord Cofield's cabinet in the 1980s, and if I may just recall, there were three really powerful members of that commission. Clearly, Jacques Delors was the most powerful, and he was the godfather. But Arthur Cofield and Peter Sutherland were really worked very closely together, and certainly Lord Cofield had a greater respect for Peter Sutherland than any of the other commissioners, apart from Jacques Delors. And I think they did work very closely together to create the single market, because you cannot have an internal market without a strong competition policy. Mm-hmm. And Peter Sutherland was the first strong competition commissioner, just as Arthur Cofield was the first strong internal market commissioner. My question, however, is about China. Pascal, do you think that China can be brought into a globalized rules-based system? As you said, they haven't really obeyed the rules up to now. Trump is right about that. Do you think that's just a gradual thing and you can see a global system working, perhaps based on WTO or some successor, or do you think we'll end up with sort of two rules-based systems, a Chinese rule system and a Western rule system?
Okay. I'll take the question in the back.
Good afternoon. Many thanks for your talk. I'm a student here. I was wondering, what are your takes, what are your views on climate change? Would globalization in its current form be compatible with some of the reforms which would be needed? And if not, what kind of reforms should we need? Thank you.
Okay. On the first question, I'll give you an anecdote about Peter. So, as we said, Delors had distributed the portfolios before what at the time was the tradition, which was called the Night of the Long Knives, where the college would agree to the portfolio distribution. That was the rule at the time. Mm-hmm. In between, it's now the president. But at the time, there had to be a deliberation. But they knew what they would have to do. And Peter Sutherland was given by the DG that would report to him, which was the competition DG, a huge file with zillions of comments on the court jurisprudence. And Peter said, when he was given this, look, I'm not going to read this. I'm going on holiday for Christmas. Give me the articles of the treaty which are dealing about competition. The guy said, "No, it's a very small sheet of paper. There are only three, four. The only thing I need to know is what the treaty says about competition. The rest I will take care." And that was, you know, the first sign for these people in DG competition that Peter would be running the thing. He didn't swallow anything of what they... Now, I know that later on he did this, but his first view was, I have to understand what's in the treaty so that I make up my own mind on what I can do with that. And by the way, he sometimes was pretty bold in interpreting the treaty in a way that had not happened before, which is why you're absolutely right. He was quite rapidly seen as the first real competition enforcer in the Commission. On China, frankly speaking, I don't know. But what I know is that this is the defining issue of the times to come. Whether China is on its own, in political terms, in philosophical terms, in economic terms, in social terms, in which case the rivalry with the West is inevitable, and then we have to try and moderate and contain this so that we don't fall into the Thucydides trap, or within China there is a brewing that will moderate this exceptionalism. But I don't know. What I know, that what I hear about democracy with Chinese characteristics, or socialism with Chinese characteristics, which looks like capitalism, or capitalism with Chinese characteristics, which looks like socialism, are things which are, you know, oxymorons, which are used to paint, to hide a deep misunderstanding about what we're after. Now, if you look at, I'm what makes me more pessimistic than 10 or 20 years ago is the digital world. I think in today's and tomorrow's world, the capacity of digitalization to turn a political system into an Orwell world is much bigger than we would have thought 10 or 20 years ago. So this is what worries me. And when I see what the Chinese are putting together in order to rate each individual...
credit system. Yeah.
That's a system which is totally incompatible with
democratic process.
My values, which happen to be Western values, which, by the way, I hope will still be Western values in Hungary, in Poland, or in the other side of the Atlantic. But what I'm pretty sure is that whatever way this goes, the first thing we need to do is to understand China. And you know, I'm in China three or four times a year, like I was in Japan 20 or 30 years ago. I've always been struck by the huge disproportion between the number of people down there who know us and the number of people here who know them. And this is a recipe for trouble. The first thing we have to do is raise our level of understanding. Raise our level of people learning Chinese, speaking Chinese, knowing about Chinese thought, literature, Confucius, and the rest. That's a no-brainer. For the rest, I don't know. On globalization and climate change, that's... Minouche, we could spend 2 minutes, 2 hours, 2 days, 2 weeks on this.
Yes.
It's a very complex issue. Peter Sutherland would have told you globalization is good for climate change. Because globalization is reshuffling production factors in such a way that you can use more efficiently resources, whether it's labor, capital, or scarce natural resources like water, like air. I would be a bit less. I mean, Peter was center-right. I try to remain center-left. So there's a slight little difference there. I would say Peter would be right if we had a price for carbon. So the notion that markets will take care, international division will work in a way that optimizes resources, is true with a price of carbon, roughly 50, 60 euros a ton, although I read a study last week saying that even at 250, we will not remain within 1.5, which, as you know, today has been the pitch of the IPCC, which was made public this morning. So it's complex, but I think we can use globalization and technology in order to address this, and in some cases, we have to adopt trade rules to environment protection. And by the way, this is an area, for instance, where the jurisprudence of the appellate body has gone on what, in my view, is the right side. I mean, take an issue like, and I don't want to enter into technicality, like products. And the doctrine in WTO was, at the time, that whatever way things are produced, if they are like product, they have to be treated the same way. You cannot discriminate. That was the doctrine at the time. Something that is produced in a good way and something is produced in a bad way, because you are the ones who decide whether it's good or bad, and not the level playing field. Now, this has changed. The jurisprudence of the appellate body now authorizes to treat differently, for instance, a battery which is good for environment and a battery which is bad for environment. And there's a famous case which is called Brazil retreated tires, which allowed Brazil to ban the import of retreated tires on environmental reasons. Now, the case didn't work because Brazil had done that for the whole of Mercosur, which was the rule in Mercosur. But then the judge said, you know, if retreated tires are bad for the environment, they are bad for the environment for everybody. So you have to do that for everybody, including your pals in Mercosur. Okay. These are things which are in the making. And although I know in for many people the expansion of world trade is bad for the environment, there are serious counter arguments, and it is still the case that a kilo of beans produced in Kenya and shipped to Amsterdam are less carbon emitting than a kilo of beans produced in Netherlands with gas and shipped to Amsterdam. That remains true.
Okay. Here, and gentleman in the back. Sorry, right here. And then here.
Thank you. Walter Czekli from the European Institute. One thing that surprises me about the Trump administration, one had thought that the United States turns in on itself, but what it actually does is trying to be again a hegemon, the one who can push others around. To what extent do you think that a Canada that has now in the NAFTA treaty that, you know, it has to notify the United States if it wants to do a trade deal with a non-market country, i.e. China, or the European Union when it wants to keep to the Iran nuclear deal, to what extent do you think the two can reject these types of the United States imposing its foreign policy on others?
Okay, extrajudicial United States.
William Keegan, The Observer. Thank you very much for your fascinating discussion. Mr. Lamy, what is your reaction to Brexiters who say all we need to do is leave the European Union and adopt WTO rules?
Okay, very good.
I'm Sarah Hobart, and I'm the Sutherland Chair here at DLSE, so it's wonderful that you can be here to celebrate his legacy. But my question is, you talked about deglobalization as though it's a problem that's rooted in the US, and also Brexit is a part of this. But of course, we also have anti-globalization sentiment on the continent, indeed also in France. And we saw when the EU was negotiating with Canada that a single regional parliament almost blocked the trade agreement. So I'm wondering whether the EU is increasingly going to find itself in a situation where it can be held hostage by a single populist party in power and a single one of its soon-to-be 27 member states. That in fact it's not so simple that the EU will always be this forerunner and spokesperson for global, the liberal world order.
Thank you, Sarah. Pascal, okay. Three big questions.
On the first question, I read about this piece, including in today's FT, that the US have introduced in the new NAFTA a clause that if Mexico or Canada want to have a trade agreement with the non-market, they have to notify. So what? notification is not a big thing to do. It's a political concession, which Trump will sell at a very high price to his constituency, probably in lying, by the way, in saying, I made sure they won't have any agreement with these terrible Chinese. But this is cosmetic. And by the way, we Europeans have in our trade agreements a clause that says that our trade partner is committed not to give a better treatment to anybody than us, which in terms of reaching a bit beyond the sort of normal behavior is also there. We have this clause in our trade agreements. So, as I said, you need to have this China-US rivalry as a background. Trading system is part of a global system that encompasses other dimensions. That's a reality, and it happened that in order to make America great again, Trump believes he has to make China weaker. That's his political stance. That's how he got elected. That's the meat he needs to give to his dogs every day, and that's what he does. In order, by the way, to win the midterm elections and possibly be reelected next time. And that's something which, you know, we have to recognize as a political fact. But I don't think that... it's a bit like what they put in this NAFTA thing about a $15 minimum wage in the car industry.
Yeah.
When you look at where the U.S. federal minimum wage is, which is less than half of the $16, you know, it's laughable. But politically, it's clever.
Yeah. But there, you imply, sorry to interrupt you, that there is a fundamental premise of trade theory that there are gains from trade, that both sides benefit, that it is not a zero-sum game or a fixed pie. And that philosophy of you must suffer so that I can gain is fundamentally at odds with trade.
I totally agree. I mean, it has a name, which is mercantilism.
Right.
And part of human economic history has been with mercantilism. Mm. I mean, we've moved from that, depending on countries, from, let's say, the end of the 18th century until now,
right.
Which is why it's a bit surprising to see a sort of 18th century doctrine back in the Oval Office. But no, that's the way he thinks.
Mm.
And it's absolutely true that that's the way he sees things. This is why he believes that the U.S. trade deficit is a problem
exactly.
Which is totally wrong and which totally contradicts his view that it's about making America first. The biggest reason why America is first on this planet is the dollar. That's the biggest reason why America is first. And why do the U.S. have a trade deficit? Because they have the supremacy of the dollar. These two things are economically totally entangled. There is a huge contradiction in the notion that I'm the U.S. president and I have the dollar and I don't want a trade deficit. It just doesn't make sense. The reason why they have a trade deficit is because everybody is looking for dollars. They print dollars. Everybody has debts in dollars, including the Chinese, by the way, and they buy dollars. So this is, I mean, in the LSE, analyzing what Trump has in mind economically is probably, I mean, the sort of worst-case scenario you could give to students in explaining how not to think properly in economics. The problem being that he's the president of the U.S. and he has been extremely successful politically because this is about emotions. And whether we like it or not, in the LSE or elsewhere, economics still remain something which is very rational.
Yes.
Very rational, and that's the problem. On your point about anti-globalization, I mean, you're absolutely right. There are anti-globalization surges for reasons which we mentioned, which is that some people believe that globalization doesn't work for them or is unduly interfering with their beliefs or their collective preferences. And the reason why this Belgian region, because Belgium is a country where trade agreements have to go to regional parliaments, which is a bit of an oddity when you have an EU trade policy at EU level, but you know, that's Belgium. We all have our stone in our shoes. But the guy who headed this fight, Paul Magnet, which is a good friend of mine, is not at all an anti-globalizer. I mean, he's not in favor of deglobalization. He just thought that because Canada is producing goods or food which can use shale gas being bad, we should have in the US, in the EU-Canada agreement, something that says that what Canada exports is not done with shale gas. And this is for purely political reasons, because he has a strong green constituency that doesn't like shale gas. No. This is not deglobalization. Deglobalization is another thing. Deglobalization is we have a system that has immensely interpenetrated our production systems of goods and services. This is bad. And we have to get rid of that for reasons which basically have to do with sovereignty. And these are two different things. And I think they need to be considered. I mean, I can understand extremely well. I mean, I opposed people in Seattle who were demonstrating against WTO because this was bad for poor countries. And I still believe I was right, because it hasn't been bad for poor countries, it has been good. So this side of the argument is, history has given an answer. Minouche was right a moment ago, which said, now, you know, remember Mitterrand in the Bundestag in 83 saying, pacifists are on the west and Euro missiles are on the east. And this was the big argument to convince the German that they should step in and join on the Euromissile question. The reality of the world today is that anti-globalizers are on the north and pro-globalizers are on the south, in many ways, which we need to understand in order to cope with the roots of the problem. And the roots of the problem are not in globalization. The roots of the problem are in the way you address the problems that creating trade efficiencies raises in economic and social constituencies. But it's not anti-globalization. If Trump is after anti-globalization, this is another story. It's a new ideology. It's a new paradigm. And we have then to cope with that as such.
Question on Brexiters who argue go to WTO.
Yeah. Sorry, I missed this one. In trade regimes, it's like in football leagues. You have a top league and you have the bottom league. And in between, you have two or three or four leagues. Now, the internal market is the top league. The WTO is the bottom league. That's the reality. Unless you are Korea, which is not a member of WTO, which is even worse than the bottom league, but that's Korea, North Korea.
North Korea.
Okay, so that's so if you want to move from the top league to the bottom league, this will be tough, which is why better try and look at something in between, which is what the problem of the thickness of the border is. If you want a thick border, you go to WTO terms. Now, for those of you who have a bit of trade knowledge, The WTO regime is a very good regime for 164 countries, but it's a bad regime for the ones who have a much better system. So moving back again to a much worse system is an issue. On top of that, when people say we should go back to WTO terms, you have to understand that, for instance, in the case of the European Union, of which the UK is still a member, the level of trade opening of the European Union goes way beyond its WTO regime. EU has committed in the WTO a degree of trade opening, which is A, EU is practicing a degree of trade opening, which is B, and B is much larger than A. So moving to the pure WTO regime, which is the assumption of your question, is moving back much more than we probably believe. Because if you look at the detail, for instance, of EU services opening commitments in some areas, they are very limited. And we are doing more because we believe it's good for us. But legally speaking, we've reserved the right in services to do much less than what we do. So that's the answer to your question. It's not a question, you know, it's just a question of what is the degree of trade openness you want to run.
Okay. Last two questions, the gentleman here and Eric.
Harry, as a former FT columnist and friend of Peter's, I just wondered how these questions of globalization that we've been talking about intersect with those of migration, which Peter devoted much of his energies to in the last years of his life with great commitment and eloquence. And it seems that migration could be seen as a sort of success of globalization, but obviously it hasn't been addressed successfully by the EU, particularly at an ethical level, I would say, and certainly not by our country, which I think has failed miserably. And Peter lambasted us quite rightly, I think, on many occasions. So I just wanted to ask that question.
Okay. Eric, just here.
Eric Bergloff, Institute of Global Affairs, and that's actually where Peter had his professor in practice. He was the first professor in practice we had. Actually, my question is very close to the previous one, and it, because towards the end of his life and in the last decade of his life, he was completely committed to migration as a topic, and of course he saw the connections to trade and to human mobility and how closely this is related, and he left remarkable contributions. He created the Global Forum for Migration and Development. He moved in the International Organization on Migration inside the UN structures. Just this year we have these global compacts on migration and refugees, or migrants and refugees, which very much was his thinking and his spirit. So my question is very similar. It's, you know, he thought of the solution in Europe had to be part of something global in terms of migration. And how do you see a way forward when it comes to creating a common migration policy in Europe?
Well, first, you're absolutely right. Peter Sutherland was coherent. He was in the favor of openness for goods, services, people. And he believed this would be good, A, for his country, and Ireland is a country that knows a bit about immigration, I think, history, and B, it would be good for his beliefs, because it was about, you know, human dignity, openness. So that's why when he left the sort of trade field, he moved into that while having other business occupations. Second, the first question talked about migration. Your second question talked about mobility. It happened that the Institut Jacques Delors in Paris is working on a big piece about EU policy in this area, which we would like to issue before the 2019 European elections, start campaigning in order to re-put this issue in the right ideological frame. And the right ideological frame is not migration, it's mobility. And by the way, if you look at the planet, the big issues with mobility is not in Europe. The big issue with mobility is within Africa. The amount of migration happening on this planet is huge in the continent and a relatively small in a situation where, for a number of specific reasons, which have to do with what happened in the periphery of the European Union, we've had this crisis stemming mostly from the Syrian war, although we've had this problem for a long time. Now, I agree that for the moment, while people on the continent, in a vast majority, recognize that this is an EU issue, and this is a big change in public opinions. 10 years ago, public opinion would have said this is a national issue, and the part of the right-wing political spectrum that played on this played it on a nationalistic card. This has changed. It's now seen as a much more pan-European issue. And by the way, if you look at the Italian reaction, the Italian reaction and the why Italians were deceived and voted, for some of them, the way they voted with the present majority, it's not that they believe Italy should run the migration issue. They believe Europe should run it, and we've let them down, which in many ways is something that does make sense. So I think we have to reshape this. We have to relook at that, and if possible, introduce a sort of difference, which is a tricky one, in terms of public opinion, between refugees, and there is a specific category of migrants, which are refugees, and with economic migrants, which is different. And the whole problem of, you know, how you organize this, but I think we've run this issue in the European Union for the last 3, 4, 5 years in trying to fix the way the system works without a common view of what should be the system about. So we have an ideological dissensus, and we spend our time trying to fix the technicalities of the issue. That will not work. We have a dissensus, and we need, given that it is an issue that has to be run at European level, we need to find some way of consensus, and I recognize it's very difficult if you have Orban around the table. That's a tough issue, and I agree that we didn't get it right, but what I'm convinced is that it's not a national solution that will help getting it right. I don't think so. I don't think so.
Okay. Thank you. It's been a huge pleasure for me, and I think for everyone here, Pascal, to hear you give, I think, what is the most fitting possible intellectual tribute to Peter Sutherland's legacy, as well as, I think, for many people in the room, a personal tribute to the ideas and influence that he had on the world. I also wanted to thank the Sutherland family for joining us here today. It made it a much, much more meaningful occasion to have you here, and I hope you felt the admiration in the room for Peter's legacy here at the LSE and with our colleagues from University College Dublin. I'd like to invite everyone to join us for a reception, which is just one floor down in the senior common room of the school, to honor Peter further and to share in each other's company. So join me in thanking Pascal for a wonderful talk.